observations of non-radiative accretion flows or something like that. So the problem, the general problem that I'm going to be talking about, and I'm going to be talking about observations mostly, is the one of trying to answer the question of why the nearby galactic nuclei are much, much dimmer than the active galactic nuclei in distant galaxies. So we heard a lot about the presence of black holes in the nearby galaxies. The question is that these black holes are extremely inactive. Okay, and that's what we've been trying to answer for, it's been a long-standing problem of trying to understand this, and it has become to a particularly sharp focus now that we have Chandra, because with the X-ray, this Chandra X-ray observatory, we have actually been able to put very strong constraints on whether or not we do have non-radiative accretion flows. The observations are certainly not good enough as to see accretion flows. So I'm talking about constraints we can put on the physics of the accretion in these nuclei, not so much on the direct observations yet. So for what the observations are concerned, as I said, I'm going to be mostly focused on Chandra, because these are the new and most stringent constraints we have. So as I said, there's it's long been known that black holes are extremely luminous in galaxies, the nuclei of galaxies in the past, in the quasar phase, so at higher redshifts that have luminosities approaching about 10 to the 45, 10 to the 47 Hertz per second. And in the standard paradigm, we think that this high luminosity is in fact due to accretion onto the central black holes. So it's a very simple problem that we're looking at in some sense. I mean, at least in the formulations that it's needed now to try and put this sort of simple constraints on it, we have matter accretion onto the black hole. So a certain luminosity is coming out, just conversion of m dot c square. We think this in the quasar phase, things roughly go at the maximum luminosity, which is the Eddington limit. We certainly know that these black holes are still present in the nearby galaxies, but we don't see anything like the luminosities that we see in the quasar phase. So what's going on? It's pretty simple, as depicted by this extremely simple relation. Okay, so if we don't see much luminosity, it's either because they're not accreting much mass, or because these efficiencies that tells us about the conversion of mass into energy is much lower. Okay, there isn't much choice in there. Okay, so that's what we want to constrain. And if we do this game observationally, what we want to do is, first of all, try and measure very well what this is. So how much power is actually getting out of these black holes. And then we want to have an independent way of estimating m dot, how much mass is actually falling onto these black holes. So if we can, if we have m dot c squared that is much lower than what we observe, and we can constrain this well, then we have to go into claiming that something else is going on in the accretion physics, so which is contained in this efficiency. We know this efficiency of matter when falling into the black holes, the energy released by viscous dissipation can be all radiated away. This is the case of standard thin accretion disks. This efficiency is about 10%. But there's been a lot of discussion on other type of accretions, this so-called advective, non-radiative, Bondi-like, whatever, accretion flows that can be relevant for these problems, where in fact this accretion efficiency can be much, much lower, simply because, and Elliot right after me will go into the details of this and other issues, because there can be situations in which the energy released by viscosity doesn't get radiated away. It falls into the black hole before it has a chance of being radiated away. So, okay, my talk was about discussing this regime of accretion versus observations. As I said, if we can constrain M dot and L really well, then we can make some claims about what this is, and therefore on what the relevant accretion physics is for this low luminosity black holes. Okay, why is Chandra really good? Well, we already have black hole masses, at least for all of the cases I'm going to be talking about. We really want to look at the best constrained cases. We're certainly going to look at black holes for which the mass has been constrained. Chandra, what it's doing for us, as I will show you, is providing us a direct measurement of the X-ray luminosity coming from these nuclear sources, which in most cases was not there before because the sources are so faint we couldn't see them. This is nice because really the X-ray luminosity probes most directly the accretion power, and we didn't have it before. And in some way or another, Chandra is also able to give us very strong constraints or some constraints on what the mass accretion rate is in this nuclei as well. So, okay, let's get into it. What is L? Okay, this most straightforward one, we just go out and look at this nuclei, okay? So the ones I'm going to be concentrating on is mostly M87, the famous active galaxies in the nearby. This is just the famous HST picture with the gas swirling around its center. There's a very good mass determination from gas dynamics for its black hole, about 3 billion solar masses. Then I'm going to also mention a few issues about our galactic center again, which is an extremely compelling evidence for a black hole mass at its center. These are also sort of the prototype of low luminosity black holes. They are the most constrained and certainly some of the most interesting cases. Okay, so as I said, we want to see and go and measure how much power output. What we needed in most cases was good constraints to the X-ray power. Here we are. This is a Chandra images of some of these galaxies. Again, I will concentrate mostly on M87. In fact, Sagittarius A will also be discussed by Elliot in the next talk. But these are basically clear detection we've had with Chandra of nuclear point sources in the nuclei of some of these elliptical galaxies and Sagittarius A. Some other galaxies have also been observed, but in those cases, even for Chandra, their nuclear point sources are faint enough that only upper limits could be put into the nuclear flux. So this is work by Lowenstein et al. This observation was made by Wilson and Young, and there was another observation with Chandra with a grating by Marshall et al. That gets similar answers, certainly totally consistent answers for the flux of the nuclear source. This is the observation by Baganov et al. Somewhere there in the middle of all this mess, there's a Sagittarius A, and this is another case for which a clear detection of a nuclear point source has been made with Chandra. Okay, besides the nuclear point source, we see all of this extended emission, extended gas, that is going to be kind of handy when we try to estimate how much mass is falling into this black hole. This is sort of the gas in the vicinity of the center is what we think is actually falling into these black holes. Okay, there's lots of structures in here as well. Let's not go into this at all right now. Here is Chandra looking at these point sources, finding an X-ray luminosities for particularly Sagittarius A, we didn't have any detection before. And this is sort of the state, again, of the best two cases. I'm just looking at these because they're the best constrained ones, but certainly everything I say about these two is totally consistent with the less constrained black hole cases. So I'm just sort of trying to get down to the main issues by showing the best examples. Okay, so this is a spectral energy distribution for M87. So this is this luminosity we're looking for, how much power is getting out of here. This is just plotted in nu and nu, just to show where this power is coming out versus nu. This is limits in the radio band. There's Keck and Gemini and infrared HST. Here is the new Chandra measurement, consistent with some previous measurement. Sagittarius A, again, the spectral energy distribution derived by a number of people. Lots of points here in the radius submillimeter band. And finally, this detection with Chandra, again, in nu and nu. Okay, for M87, we immediately see that this source is about factor of 10 to the 6 below Eddington for its mass. This is again of a similar factor below. So these are extremely low luminosity black holes. You don't really get a chance to put this, hide a lot of radiation in any band. Now we've constrained the spectral energy distribution way too well, I think, to say that maybe there's emission coming from other bands, okay? So, but, I mean, we certainly don't expect to see this sort of luminosities. We know that there isn't that much gas around galaxies now to expect these black holes to be accreting at this close to their Eddington luminosity. So, as I said, we really want to have a way, now that we have a good estimate of this luminosity, of constraining actually how much mass is accreting into this black hole. Okay, so this is where things become less straightforward. Okay, it's not just taking a telescope and looking at things. We need to sort of make some model of how we're going to calculate this accretion rate. Okay, simplest thing we can do. Probably not so right, but anyway, we'll see. The simplest thing we can do is to say, okay, we have a black hole, we have all this hot extended X-ray gas that we see in the surrounding of the black hole, which should contain, in fact, most of the mass, particularly in the deep potential gravitation of elliptical galaxies. Let's see where the gravitational potential of the black holes dominates the dynamics of this gas. Let's look at the radius where basically this gas is going to start feeling the presence of the black hole and therefore fall in. Okay, this is, if we can determine where this radius is, then we know that mass, this capture or accretion radius, which is just a function of the mass of the black hole and the thermal energy of this gas, its temperature, then we can just apply mass conservation and find out how much mass is actually inflowing from this point. So at this point, simply what we're doing, let's look at this gas. Where is this gas going to start falling into the black hole, given that it has some internal energy? Okay, that's all we're doing. Simple first order thing. Okay, so if we want to, but we know we want to measure, because this is not the ideal Bondi problem, we really want to measure densities and temperatures in order to resolve this at this Bondi radius. So we want to know the state of the gas at this point, okay? So with Chandra, again, for the first time, we have been able actually to resolve this accretion radius, this capture radius for, certainly for M87 and Sagittarius A, under this assumption that that the gas has just some internal energy, okay? So this is an image, just a plot of the temperature in M87 versus radius. So we see the temperature kind of going down as it follows the potential of the galaxy, simply. And this is where this accretion radius sits in M87. So it's within Chandra resolution, okay? What this means is that we can finally directly estimate this capture radius and this Bondi accretion rate, because we have the temperature and densities of matter in there. We know the state of the gas at this point because it's resolved. So this is the projected density profile, again, of M87. We can get the value out of here at this point. Exactly, we know the temperature. We estimate an accretion rate onto the black hole in M87, which is about 0.1 solar masses per year, okay? And this is resolved by Chandra. Okay, according to the simple understanding that we put in the way we calculate M dot. Okay, so back to this. Now, as I said, we have L, we have M dot. What's happened? Can we make a case for eta having to be different than in standard accretion? Well, again, I'm showing the case of M87, just concentrating on the bottom here for a second. Okay, here we just put in the M dot just calculated, and if this accretion rate, if accretion was occurring indeed at high radiative efficiency, like in standard accretion model, we would expect to see almost about 10 to the 45 Hertz per second coming out of M87. As I showed to you before, and it's up here again, we know that the luminosity of M87 doesn't exceed about 10 to the 41 ergs per second. So the conclusion here is pretty straightforward, is given that M dot is small, it's not small enough to make up for the lack of this luminosity, it has to be that this accretion efficiency has to be much lower than this 0.1 value, i.e. everything is consistent with having an accretion flows. In fact, there's a very strong constraint, if we're doing this M dot right, that accretion is indeed occurring at lower radiative efficiencies. In fact, what it's plotted over here, and I don't want to go into the details of models, is one very simple ADEF model, sort of with a typical density scaling is r to the minus 3 half, very close to a Bondi flow, just its velocity is alpha, the time free fall, that's sort of a major difference than to a Bondi flow, and temperature calculates itself consistently. These sort of models give rise to this kind of spectrum, which has some synchrotron emission and Comptonized emission up to higher energies, and this sort of ADEF Bondi-like flow has, in fact, the right inefficiency to explain a significant fraction of the energy we see. Okay, it's certainly totally consistent with the data points we have. So the ADEF Bondi-like accretion seems to be fully consistent with any of the observational constraints we have. Whether this emission is actually due to this flow, we don't know. Certainly we know that for the case of M87, there are significant components of these nuclear emissions that are still due to the jet. The jet is extremely important, collimated at very small distances from the black hole. So certainly they could easily explain most of this emission. The point that we're making now here is just simply that there could also be a contribution from its nucleus through accretion in this particular mode, but whether it's relevant to explaining most of the spectral energy distribution, it doesn't matter. The major point is that indeed there's a good case that eta has to be smaller than this, okay, if this is the right M dot that we're putting in. Okay, so this is Sagittarius A star. Again, as I said earlier, we'll talk about more of the subtleties of this, but the same line applies completely in the same sort of consistent way as I explained for M87. For Sagittarius A, again, Chandra has good resolution enough to go and pin down and resolve this accretion radius and measure properties of the gas right at the accretion radius, such as its temperature and its density. So we can determine a Bondi accretion rate onto Sagittarius A to a much better precision than before. With this kind of accretion rate, we expect the luminosity of our galactic center to exceed 10 to the 40 ergs per second. As you can see, what we see is much less than that, about four orders of magnitude less. Again, a very compelling case that the radiative efficiency of these accretion flows has to be smaller than about 0.1. Okay, so again, the same thing, and again, the sort of line whereby a simple ADEF model kind of fits the observational constraints. Again, there are issues about some quiescent and flared X-ray luminosity, some possible contribution from extended jet-like emission in this guy as well, but this argument doesn't have anything to do with trying to explain the details of the spectrum, which maybe are not so important still at this point because the constraints are not so good in terms of the details. Okay, so this is the major argument that relies totally on the fact that we're assuming that the Bondi rate is what I estimated in the way that I explained to you in the simple way is what is relevant. Okay, so as I said, everything is consistent just with simple low radiative efficiency accretion flows. There has been very strong theoretical motivations to hypothesize, and to also lots of numerical work that strongly supports the idea that under such circumstances, in circumstances where the gas is accreted at low radiative efficiencies, it actually develops very strong outflows or very strong convection. Elliot will talk about all of this, so I won't talk about very much about what happens and what are the strong theoretical motivation for this. But the very, you know, the bottom line of this is that what we expect if this was to occur is that the densities and would be much lower if the speed parameter almost approaches one, would be much lower in the centers of these accretion flows than they are in the standard ADEF. So if this was really what was going on, we would expect to see high ratios of high energy luminosity to low energy luminosity, Bremsstrahlung to radio, say, for this kind of black hole mass. This is not what we observe, so we kind of observe a one-to-one ratio, and this is maybe not so important because in any case, we say that there could be a significant contribution from the jet. The punchline here is that at the moment, we have absolutely no requirement from the observations to introduce anything like this in order to explain anything. Okay, so there's no unambiguous observational evidence that we have to invoke anything that, although theoretically, is highly justifiable. Just observationally, there's no requirement for it at all. This is just one of the major effects. There are other things that we could look for, but again, in order to try and see whether this is going on, but it's not really necessary. Clearly, if this was going on, because M dot, basically, onto the black hole is significantly reduced, it means that the contribution of the accretion flow to our spectral energy distribution just decreases. Okay, so if we get less luminosity out of these flows, but we know that there are other contributions to our spectral energy distribution, such as the jet, what we're saying is that simply we will never be able to see it. We will never be able to see the accretion flows if really the accretion rates were much smaller than this, because a lot of the luminosity that we have in M87 could, or even in Sagittarius A, could be ascribed easily to the jet, say, or other components. Okay, so now that I've given you these pictures and strongly argued that maybe radiative efficiency is totally consistent with what we're observing, in fact, maybe it seemed to be required, I'm going to sort of mess all of this up because I'm going to start saying that maybe, in fact, the simple way in which we have calculated these accretion rates onto these black holes is not maybe so appropriate, it's not maybe good enough, okay? And again, I'm going to argue this, given that I was asked to talk about observations, from the observational point of view. What do we see? Why am I saying this? Well, what we based our calculation of the accretion rate on was the fact that we have this hot gas in the center of these elliptical galaxies, or even now we see in Sagittarius A, and this is sort of very relaxed, is in hydrostatic equilibrium, has some sort of steady state, and therefore its energy is just its in gas thermal energy, okay? So it will only, we find the radius at which this gas is accreted by balancing its internal energy, its gas thermal energy, with the binding energy of the black hole. But what are we seeing, really? I mean, this is, again, a really nice representation by Young, Wilson, and Mundell of the central regions of M87. This is what we're claiming, the gas that is being accreted onto the black hole, all of this extended emission around here. This just does not look relaxed, does not look steady state at all. We see all these structures, these holes in the red stuff, okay, in the Chandra image, and the evidence that the gas in the center here is not relaxed is certainly given also by the flattening of our density profile that I was showing earlier on as well. Okay, so there's an r to the minus one profile that should keep going up unless there's something going on, and here we see a clear evidence of this flattening out. Okay, so this could only occur if there is a strong mass dropout, a strong cooling flow, which certainly we don't see, or there's something else messing up the inflow of this gas, okay? And clearly, the way I plotted this is very suggestive of what seems to be the explanation of what's messing up the gas in the central regions, what's making, basically pushing this gas away. We see all this hole in here, okay? In fact, in this representation of Young, Wilson, and Mundell, they overplotted on the Chandra image the 6 centimeter radio emission from the jet. Okay, we see this very nice one-to-one correspondence with this emission and all of these holes that we see in the X-ray gas. Okay, so it's not, and a correspondence between the region where the jet is impacting all this energy to where this density profile, sort of average density profile of the gas, flattens off completely. So I think this gives us very strong indications that our assumptions that the gas here is not being pushed, it's just, you know, they're sitting happily in hydrostatic equilibrium, it's not good. It's not good enough, okay? There's clearly stuff being pushed out. We see the holes, we see this jet impacting some very significant actions in there, Okay, so this is the case again of M87. The nuclei observed, again, by Lowenstein et al., sort of show a similar property, this significant flattening of the density of the surface brightness profiles, the density profiles in the inner regions, okay? And all of these galaxies now have significant sort of radio lobes, radioactivity jets in their nuclei, okay? This is just a bit of a much more sketchy than in the case of M87, but certainly supports the same sort of things going on. So what am I getting at? What is this doing? Well, I hope it's sort of obvious enough if, you know, you have a jet pushing gas away and you're trying to accrete this gas into the mineral, it's just not going to get there as much as we thought it would. So in a very, very rough sense, what I'm saying is that if we try and parameterize sort of the energy that we're dumping into the ISM by pushing gas away with this jet, and I won't go too much into details of this, but doing very simple scaling, which are also supported by numerical simulation of Reynolds, Hans et al., what we're looking at is basically gas that is going to feel the potential the gravitational potential of the black hole much closer in. Basically, the ISM gas is being disturbed by these bulk flows, by this jet. There's more energy besides this thermal energy that is going to keep this gas from not accreting onto the black hole, or is going to make this accretion radius shrink significantly, okay? And that's all basically, this is very, in a very rough way, sort of the argument. And it can be formalized much better than this. But just to get to it, so if we shrink basically the region where the accretion occurs, we expect the accretion rate itself to be decreasing significantly. Basically, one can find very simply that as long as there are bulk flows in this ISM gas that exceed its sound speed, the accretion rate onto this black hole should be significantly affected. Okay, if we're pushing gas away, it won't get into the black hole. This is really simply what this is saying. So, what's really going on? Well, one other piece of sort of confusing, but kind of neat thing is that the jet kinetic energy, which has been estimated from the radio observations, roughly corresponds to our origin, our m.c square from the Bondi accretion rate. So the higher accretion rate that we had estimated, and on which I made most of my arguments, roughly gives rise to a power, that it's of the order of what we expect the jet kinetic energy to be. So maybe this Bondi rate, you know, this higher M dot rate, the one that we are able to estimate, has some relevance to this problem in some sense, but it just supports that maybe these nuclei are actually sort of undergoing cycles of activity, which is what's suggested by the fact that it's a transient phenomenon as well. So what I'm trying to get at is that maybe, in fact, there is accretion at these rates at some point when things are relaxed, then we start off the jet interacts with the interstellar medium, shuts off accretion itself, the jet shuts off, and until a relaxed system is resumed again, this cycle won't start again. So what I'm trying to say is that maybe now we're observing M87 at a point where it's accreting much less because the jet, as we've seen, is already disturbing the ISM significantly. Okay, so this, though, is kind of cute because it kind of supports this idea that if this is true, the energetics all make sense at some level. And this is also consistent with estimate of Young and Wilson of what the energy should be in the X-ray gas. Now we can probe the energetics of the jet by also looking at these huge holes that they're digging into the X-ray gas and see how much energy that requires. And so all of these numbers sort of consistent with each other, roughly. So the overall energetics of the nucleus and the jet and the ISM. So, okay, I kind of left out Sagittarius A now. I don't know what's happening there, but certainly things don't look very relaxed in this ISM gas shown here in green again in this image by Baganov et al. This is again the radio emission around the nucleus as well, but we'll leave it at that. So what are my conclusions? I started by... Sorry for the fuzziness of this, but I guess the conclusions are also fuzzy. Chandra has definitely provided us direct measurements of nuclear X-ray point sources, the nuclear power in X-rays from these black holes. This is certainly very important if we want to do any, you know, want to estimate what these are getting out. It's definitely providing us measures of the properties of the gas, densities, and temperatures close to the Bondi radius. And if we believe this is where the radius at which material is being accreted, we can estimate Bondi accretion rates and show unambiguously now that the accreted luminosity is much, much less than 0.1 m dot Bondi c square. So in all of the elliptical galaxy nuclei in Sagittarius A, a low efficiency or rate of Bondi flow is totally consistent with any of this observational evidence. That's what I've shown, if indeed this is the mass accretion rate. But what Chandra, I think, and we cannot forget this, although it's sort of messing up all of this nice picture that was coming out with Chandra, Chandra is definitely showing us that there is the gas in the very center, very close to the black hole, is getting totally messed up. So that this... this estimate of the mass accretion rate certainly needs to be looked at a lot more carefully. And it certainly suggests, when we put together this with the radio and jet the activity of this nucleus, and this certainly puts forward the hypothesis that maybe we're just seeing a low cycle, a low luminosity cycle of this nucleus. And I'll stop at that.
With respect to your ram pressure argument, since the jet's anisotropic, what to prevent a significant fraction of the body weight mass flowing into the jet and not?
The jet is anisotropic up to a certain extent. The radio image I was showing to you it certainly shows that this radio plasma is almost occupying a quasi-spherical region. So the initial phase of the jet, when the ram pressure is dominated by the ram pressure, will be fairly anisotropic until the jet maybe stops at some point because of the pressure of the ISM. And at this point, it will sort of expand according to models of Reynolds et al. As well in a sort of... roughly buoyantly, roughly at its sound speed, and in a quasi-spherical fashion. So actually, it will affect, its energy will sort of affect a larger area, much larger area than the part that is, you know, collimated. So, and that's what seems to be supported also by the radio observations and the X-ray cavities that, you know, they're big and quasi-spherical.
What can you say about the duty cycle of activity that you would expect, and would you expect expect to see any sources that are on?
I guess so. It clearly depends on how much time things stay on and they're off. But I don't think we would be too inconsistent with seeing some sources that are on. For instance, in the Perseus cluster has a certainly very bright AGN. But the timescales are tricky.
I mean, is there any particular source you think is on right now?
Yeah, I don't remember. It's 1275 is the center of the Perseus. Yeah, it's 10 to the 45 orbs per second. So, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, I haven't looked at that in details, but it should be looked at. I'm not sure. I think it's less than the amount of mass in the hot X-ray gas, but it's certainly nice also because to be looking at that, because definitely there's now Chandra is sort of resolving gas, which is roughly at the same distance as this disk that you're talking about. So it'd be nice to compare with that, definitely.
In your picture of the M87 galaxy, you had roughly 30 arc seconds was corresponding to the radius that you were saying was affected by the jet.
Yes, roughly.
Does that correspond to the Bondi accretion radius, or is it?
No, this is still far further out. It's about a factor of 10 further out. Okay, so the argument I'm making is that the gas is coming in messed up. You know, it's already before it gets even to our classical Bondi radius. But yeah, if one wants to solve this problem better, it would have to know better what's happening even closer in. Yeah.
Ford exactly worked on that M87 disk.
In the optical.
In the optical with the HST.
Yeah.
One fascinating suggestion they made there was that they said that based on the known disks so far, it's exactly those disks which are within the Keplerian region which show optical line emission, and those which are not in the Keplerian region which don't. Is that still true? And in that case, does that mean that in the M87 disk, that I mean, they infer that there's 10 to the 7th solar masses of gas in that disk, of which the ionized mass is negligible. Mm-hmm. Is that folklore still true and universally applicable? Anyone know?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah, I didn't know about these numbers either, actually. But it's interesting. I don't know if any.
Do you have any comment on that? There are lots of men unseen mass
fighting on these things. I couldn't really hear the question. So not completely. Anyway, in all the other disks, the masses of the older one would have gone to 10 to the 5 solar mass. I didn't hear what you said. But it doesn't have dust. I guess that's the difference, right? It doesn't have dust.
There are two lobes perpendicular to the disk joined by a line going right through Sagittarius star of
front position now. In the first year data, we didn't feel we had enough counts to prove and really look at that strong. But when we look for a week in May, we're going to be slices we're looking through the spectrum. And it's possible, I wouldn't say that it's proof, that there may be some outflow going perpendicular to our galactic disk through Sagittarius Star. And maybe that could be not some kind of a wedge. It's clearly not collimated yet.
Yeah,
but
so
how could that kind of kinetic luminosity?
So I guess this goes back also to the point that Cole was making. I mean, it really also depends. So how much are you affecting the gas coming in by, you know, this jet? So it's certainly easy to say that it would be very effective if affected if it's quasi-spherical, basically, you know, this gas trying to flow in and you're pushing it out, sort of thing. So because gas could still fall in if it's relatively collimated. But it'd be nice to look at just at the energetics, because clearly where these jets come to a stop, as you're saying, these lobes, they must be dumping quite a bit of energy around there. And so it might have an impact on how the gas that is trying to fall in actually makes it to the center, if this you know, the energetics are high enough of this outflow. Yeah. So it might have definitely some relevance.
But as far as you know, it doesn't have to be
No, probably that doesn't help, in fact, because if it's likely to be very collimated, then gas could just flow in, you know.
I'm asked by the organizers, all the people who speak to the audience, speak up and preferably stand up so the pulse is back here. It's really, it's not well designed to sound traveling in the back of the grid.
I don't understand this thing real well, but the measurement of the jet luminosity or the energy of the jet has been 44 Hertz per second.
Yeah, it's not my measurement. It's actually a model dependent estimate, because we don't measure kinetic. Yeah. Yes. That's right. Yeah, that's the point I was trying. If you think that most of the energy of the jet is directly linked to the accretion process, yes, you're totally right. If though the you know, the jet can be tapping energy from the black holes, from the spin of the black hole, then you can add some energy in there and not ever see it in the actual accretion process, say. But yeah, if you think the two things sort of have to make sense together, yeah, I agree. I like that as well. And so.
How can we see highly accreting sources from sparkle jets?
Don't we see highly accreting sources?
We see that they are radial out wave.
Yes.
How can we imagine them? We both very limited accreting jets.
So, I mean, there's certainly, if this duty cycle kind of works, first of all, these objects are in totally different environments, so they might not have such a high impact on the gas. I mean, there's a lot more stuff trying to fall into these black holes, most likely. There's more gas in this thing. So the situation can be different than the more low-density systems that we see nearby and with much less gas. Also, there could be stages where, yeah, where there is, in fact, the jet has been launched and the nucleus, you know, if there are these duty cycles of active phases, you could have an initial phase where you see a strong jet and a strong nuclear source.